The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Monday, September 14th, 2015. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Jamal Brooks.
And this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal.
And the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Jay Cassano. He's an independent journalist who's reported from Turkey and written for many places, including The Nation, Fast Company, Vice. He's going to be talking about why the Turkish government is uprooting its peace, its temporary peace with the Kurds, and bombing them at the same time that it claims to be taking on ISIS. Well, of course, the Kurds are the prime enemies of ISIS. Also, it's been a political earthquake in Britain, in the UK. We didn't really want to talk about it until it actually happened, but it happened. Jeremy Corbyn, the next leader of the Labour Party, the leader of the Labour Party. Talk about that. David Axelrod had a kind of annoying comment about Bernie Sanders, and the mainstream media still can't seem to deal with the fact that Bernie's crushing it. Talk about that. What else we have in store, Matt?
We have that story of the tennis star James Blake,
yep,
who got tackled by the NYPD in a case of mistaken identity.
Unbelievable.
And that's actually, in my opinion, not the craziest part of it.
We'll find out what that is.
That and more. Oh, we have this disgusting video that I will have to give like a censor. What is that? Like a what we put on the CDs they used to put?
Parental advisory.
Thank you. Parental advisory.
That's an everybody advisory. You were playing this before we started the show, and I was like, yo, dude, I don't want to hear this
yes
anymore. This is gross.
Yes.
And
that'll
this
be in
foul
the better half to save the ears of our young, impressionable freebie listeners.
Young, impressionable, and really anybody else. It's horrible, but you got to hear it because, I mean, that's just life, man.
Before we get into the show, though, really quickly, did yes you hear the sad news, Michael?
What's the sad news?
Rick Perry.
Rick Perry's out.
He's out. He dropped out of the race Friday after the show, after we went off the air, around like Friday evening.
Going to miss him. I wish he had made it to the second debate. That would have been fun to
what
watch.
What are they going
to
do for that second debate? That's just going to, you're going to tune in for Santorum, Jindal, Graham, and who else is even in it?
Pataki.
And Pataki?
That's one
Perry,
of the most
Perry
depressing collection. Oh, yeah.
Rick Perry saved that thing because he would make it watchable. I mean, for all the wrong reasons and what his opinion would be, but he would make it watchable.
Oh, definitely. Well, you could. I enjoy just Graham just being like, we're all going to die.
That's true.
We're all going to die.
Sharif don't like it.
Sharif don't like it. The Muslims are coming.
What was amazing to see Rick see Rick Perry, though, Rick Perry, of all people, stand up to the words of Donald Trump and his bowing out.
Yep. Yep.
Was, we're not going to do good by demonizing Mexicans.
Yeah, well, you know, Rick Perry.
We
hardly knew ye.
I like how
it's amazing that you're actually too dumb to compete in a Republican primary. It's kind of mind-blowing.
He was also sort of like, I guess God just doesn't have this in the plans for me.
Yeah.
God was like, no, seriously. Three departments of government you would cut? Come on, man.
Listen, I felt really bad for you. I let you get as far as governor of Texas. I'm even regretting that one.
Yeah. All right. And then, obviously, happy Jewish New Year to everybody, to all of the chosen people out there, and everybody else that likes chosen people. We have Sam's
chosen.
Back.
Sam's the chosen one in this office.
No, we're chosen, too.
Well, I'm talking about in terms of being able
to
take the day off.
Oh, we're covering it for him because that's how good we are. We're willing to offend God.
For Lord Cedar.
Maybe Boss Cedar. That's a little excessive, bro. All right, really quickly, we got to talk about a couple of advertisers, and then we'll be right back with Jay Cassano. Everybody knows, folks, that shopping is awful. Well, I don't know if everybody knows that. Most people know. Most
I
people
know
think that.
That.
I know that. And who has the patience for crowded stores or the time you're trying on 10 pairs of pants? Then they don't even fit. That's why this month or today on this show, and I think in the future, we have Trunk Club as an advertiser. I'm incredibly excited about this Ooh. Advertiser. All right? Because, look, the truth of the matter is at a certain point, even if you have, as an example, a girlfriend who's into shopping, she's going to get sick of it too. The first couple of times it's cute and she's into it and she wants to see the different outfits and, you know, check out the measurements or whatever. And then the third or fourth time she's like, come on, dude, seriously. It's not romantic anymore. And with but here's the problem. You still want to look great. Even though you don't want to do that shopping, you have no patience for the stores and the long lines, and your girlfriend won't help you out anymore. And with Trunk Club, you never have to set foot in the mall again. Never again. Trunk Club takes the hassle out of shopping by shipping you a trunk of clothes that fit perfectly and make you look like $1 million with all the new fall styles.
Now, when they say a trunk of clothes, I'm looking at it right now, and they mean the entire, like everything you need.
Like a trunk, like a treasure
like
trove of clothes.
Pants, to make, shirts, shoes, glasses, jackets, gloves,
to make you,
everything.
To make you look great, to make you look slick. At trunkclub.com/majority, you answer simple questions about your style, preference, and sizes and are assigned an expert stylist. They curate clothes from the best premium brands and you approve what you like. And just like that, a trunk arrives on your doorstep filled with hand-picked clothes that are perfect for you. Try them on, keep what you like, and easily return what you don't like in their prepaid trunk. So it's perfect. You're not stuck with anything. You don't have to go back to the store to return the pants that you bought when your girlfriend wasn't with you because you misfired. Again, best of all worlds. This is not a subscription service. You only pay for the clothes that you keep from your trunk. No hidden charges, just great clothes. And right now, their entire styling service is free. Free. You get a stylist for free. Okay, power to the people. Even the shopping, you only have to pay for the clothes you keep. To take advantage, go to trunkclub.com/majority. That's trunkclub.com/majority. And one last time, that's trunkclub.com/majority for a trunk filled with clothes that you love wearing. And you don't have to go anywhere to buy. And while you're in your snazzy new attire, you're probably going to be sitting back and enjoying football season, enjoying the Pats crush everybody else, enjoying whining about the Pats crushing everybody else, whatever it is you do during football season. But you can make the whole experience a lot more interesting for yourself with FanDuel. That's right. The first book of football season is on the books. How did your fantasy team do? Did you win money? No, you can on FanDuel this weekend. Talk about the week one football game results and how your fantasies did. That's right, because it's interactive. You're tracking your team. You're seeing how they did. I haven't had a chance to join up yet, but I certainly will soon. I've been wrapped up in the U.S. Open. I'm a tennis guy, but I'm excited to get on with the football season. But you can go to FanDuel right now. FanDuel is the trusted leader in one-week fantasy football with more winners and more payouts than any other site. They're paying out over $75 million a week. This is practically like a Wall Street bank here this football season. Building a team is easy. Just pick your players, stay under the salary cap, and sit back on Sunday and watch your team win. Entry fees start at just $1. Anyone can play. I mean, come on. It's a no-brainer. Got to do this. Last year, Joe Watson from New York turned a $50 deposit into over $30,000 in 2 weeks playing fantasy football on FanDuel. Take that, Joe Watson's girlfriend who told him to stop playing games on the computer all the time. Join him and over 1 million other users who've already won money. Go to FanDuel.com and click on the microphone in the upper right-hand corner. Use my code MAJOR and sign up now. Special offer for new users. For every dollar you deposit, FanDuel will match you with $200 that gets earned as you play. That's a bonus of up to $200. Offers only good for the first 50 people that use my code MAJORITY. And no, that's
MAJOR.
MAJOR. MAJOR. Excuse me.
It's
code
like majority,
MAJOR.
But
sorry.
The code is MAJOR.
Code is MAJOR. I'm sorry. That's right.
As Go. In Major Brooks.
Major Brooks.
Reporting for duty on FanDuel.com.
Right. Go to FanDuel.com. Use my code MAJOR. Thank you, Matt. Don't forget to use my code MAJOR. FanDuel.com, where every day is a new season. That's FanDuel.com. Sign up for it today. We'll be right back. Happy Rosh Hashanah, everybody. We'll be right back with Jay Cassano on the Majority Report.
Again, if you never kill me, you're yes, I. And we say, Jehovah, life over death. Demon can't kill me again. We say, good over evil. Life over death. Satan can't kill me. Here comes the hot staple. Fire burning hotter than paper. That song you written proper than later. Protected from the crown of my head. Straight down to the very soul of the crepe, yeah. Me have a chat for them. Them send gunshot poison to your accident. Long time them a try like have my oxygen. But you're in control. Can't take me soul. Over evil. Life over death. Demon can't kill me again. Me say, good over evil. Life over death, demon can't kill me, Them put poison in a liquor, try curse me. A good thing, me no drink, me no thirsty. From the day my mother birth, me still see I hurt me, nobody can hurt me. Them disguise Jezebel in a the biggest way. Send her come to give me the biggest ache. Can it left her in dismay? A long time, them a try up until this day. Me say, good over.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. That was Chronix wishing you good over evil in the Jewish New Year. Maybe not specifically. joining us now is Jay Cassano. He's an independent journalist who's reported from Turkey. His writing has appeared in The Nation, Al Jazeera, Vice, and many other publications. He's also, as is my style on this program, apparently a good friend. So, Jay, it's always a pleasure to talk to you and great to have you on the show. How are you doing?
I'm good. Likewise, good to chat with you. Happy to be here.
It's great to have you on. So let's sort of situate the conversation. You know, I think Syria, Turkey, IS, the war against IS, the Kurds even to some degree are sort of in this cycle of kind of decontextualized crisis reporting in most of the mainstream media, in the sense that we know that there's a lot of, I guess they would say, kinetic activity or military activity going on in this part of the world. We know that ISIS is committing any number of atrocities. We know that we're sort of there engaging in military activity. Nobody's really sure of how and why and what exactly. But one thing that has really emerged clearly from every piece of reporting on this, and anybody who has even the most passing knowledge of this issue, is that the Kurdish fighters are the sort of prime on the ground antagonists of ISIS. And now Turkey, who has until relatively recently not actually taken a particularly hard line on ISIS, in fact, maybe has even been complicit in some respects with ISIS moving in and out of the Turkish-Syrian border, is starting to bomb ISIS, but they're also using this as an opportunity to re-engage militarily with Kurdish factions. So what's going on? Why has Turkey taken this moment? Give us some of the context for what's happening right now, and then we'll take it a little further back and give people more context.
Sure. I mean, so let's start with what's actually happening right now. You know, we're in the midst of an armed conflict, basically, between the Turkish state and Kurdish militants. You say, you know, that Turkey is now finally militarily engaging ISIS, mm-hmm. and that's true, but actually, you know, by every report, by any counting of bomb strikes, Turkey has hit PKK, the yes. Kurdistan Workers Party, which operates in southeastern Turkey and northern Iraq, far more than it's hit any ISIS targets. So really, Turkey is using this as cover to re-engage the PKK, and we can talk a little bit more about that later in the sort of military strategic relationship between Turkey and the U.S. in that regard. But right now, I mean, Turkey has been conducting military operations you know, in its own country. We just now recently, there was a siege of the Turkish city of Cizre, which went on for 9 days, which actually just ended a couple of days ago. And yeah. Basically, it was besieged by the Turkish military and police. And the city itself is right basically at that point, sort of a trident where the Turkish, Syrian, and Iraqi borders meet. So in Cizre, there was an enforced military curfew and military vehicles. There were soldiers and even sniper units deployed around the city. There were some citizens in Cizre who were saying that snipers were positioned in the minarets of the mosques in Cizre, which seems particularly egregious. And basically, you know, after people were able to go in when the siege was lifted, you know, it turned out somewhere between 20 and 30 civilians were killed in those 9 days. The government had Cizre on a complete media blackout, didn't allow journalists in during the siege. You know, I can count on one hand the number of journalists who either managed to get into Cizre or were already there and able to get information out, mostly through Twitter. Members of the opposition party in support of Kurdish rights, the People's Democratic Party, or HDP, attempted to visit Cizre to assess the damage and verify reports while the siege was ongoing. And their convoy was actually stopped by Turkish police 90 kilometers outside of the city, and they were forced to walk on foot. So let me just emphasize that for a moment. Yeah. Elected officials in a supposedly democratic country were blocked from visiting a city in their own territory by the state and were made to walk almost 100 kilometers. And that supposedly democratic country is currently bombing its own territory and killing its own citizens. And then amidst all of this, there's been a sort of grassroots right-wing nationalist backlash with HDP, the pro-Kurdish rights party's offices being attacked, often while reportedly police looked on and did nothing. Right. So basically where we are right now, taken all together, is Turkey is on the trajectory towards a civil war between the Turkish state and its Kurdish population.
Right. And it's it's a disgusting picture. It's an alarming picture. And the point you made about the elected officials being detained can't be underscored enough. Now, there's a couple of different aspects to this. I think actually before we go forward, and not in any great detail, there are different factions of Kurds that you've already sort of mentioned. So we have the PKK, we have some other, we have this the Democratic Party you're talking about.
Sure.
Give us a brief synopsis of the different Kurdish factions involved in this fighting and in these situations in Turkey and in Syria.
So basically, there are three groups that you really need to know about to understand the current situation. The first is the PKK, mm-hmm. which is an armed militant group that's considered a terrorist organization by both Turkey and the U.S. The PKK launched an insurgency in Turkey in 1984, and they've been fighting first for an independent Kurdish state carved out of southeast Turkey, and they've since sort of shifted that demand to be more of what they call democratic autonomy, sort of in line with, you know, like the system in Basque Country in Spain or something like that, where they get full cultural civil rights within their own self-governing unit. The second group is, like you said, the Peace and Democracy Party, which isn't a solely Kurdish group, and we can talk more about that as well. But basically, they're the mainstream party that is in parliament now and in support of Kurdish rights and autonomy. And then in Syria, we have the YPG, which is the military wing that basically controls a stretch of northern Syria right now. And the PKK and the YPG have been the most, you know, effective fighters against ISIS, along with Iraqi Kurds. And, you know, basically the PKK and the YPG are very closely allied with each other. You know, they conduct military operations and trainings together. They're distinct groups, but there's a whole lot of overlap between them ideologically and geopolitically. Now, the YPG has been working very closely with the U.S. military in coordinating airstrikes against ISIS positions. The YPG has reportedly been feeding military intelligence to the U.S. military for about a year now. And the YPG controls that swath of northern Syria, including the city of Kobani, which we heard a lot about in the media for a while, with their sort of anarchistic experiment in self-governance. But basically, you know, what we have now is, with Turkey joining the fight supposedly against ISIS, We have the U.S. fighting a terrorist group, ISIS, by allying with the allies of another terrorist group, supposed terrorist group, the PKK.
Right.
So, it's a messy situation in that regard. But Turkey itself is a key ally for the U.S. in fighting ISIS, because Turkey is, of course, a NATO member that actually has the second largest standing army of all NATO countries after only the U.S., which a lot of people don't realize. Mm-hmm. And Turkey is, of course, right there sharing a border with Syria and Iraq. So it was crucial for the U.S. to get Turkey involved in this fight. But basically, the cost of Turkey's involvement was that the U.S. Would more or less turn a blind eye to Turkey bombing the PKK.
Right. So it's another sort of unbelievable, and we will get to the U.S. sort of just this latest sort of stunning inconsistency and short-sightedness with regard to that. But let's move back here to kind of setting up why this is happening now. I think some people who listen to this program and some people have some passing sense of Turkish politics, they have a very negative impression of now he's the Turkish president, Erdogan, which is very understandable. They have a very negative impression of the kind of current Turkish government for many reasons, from if you first encountered them through the crackdown in Gezi Park to its sort of questionable, just even on the surface, kind of questionable policy towards ISIS and towards the Kurds. The paradox of these strikes against the Kurds is that this is actually sort of a reverting to type. When Erdogan and his party first came into office, they actually, and you'll talk about this more, they sort of embarked on some reforms towards Kurdish policy. And now it's almost as if they're adopting the attitude of their sort of secular nationalist opponents with regards to the Kurds. I want you to talk about where we were at with the Kurds a couple of years ago, what the accomplishments of the AKP government with regards to the Kurds were, and why now they have chosen this kind of stunning reversal of really one of their only – it seems like they're quite committed to undoing all of their legitimate accomplishments, whether economic, social, or political, and this is their latest one. Why now? What was the context, and why are they breaking it now?
Basically the answer to why is this is all about staying in power for President Erdogan, and he's actually making very cold, calculated – political decisions right now. Erdogan's current political objective is to change the Turkish political system from a parliamentary democracy to a presidential system, which would give the president executive power like in the United States. And of course, Erdogan would be that president and have that executive power. But to understand how that fits into what's going on now, we have to retrace some important developments of the last 5 years of Turkish history. So working backwards a little bit, first in June of this year, Erdogan's ruling Justice and Development Party, the AKP, lost its single-party majority in parliament, which it's held since 2002. And this meant that basically the AKP needed to form a coalition government with one of the three opposition parties in parliament. It was unable to do that for a variety of reasons, and so Erdogan called for special elections in November because of the hung parliament. But the result of these June elections was that Erdogan's ambition to have the AKP rewrite the Turkish constitution basically on his behalf was jeopardized. Mm. And the main reason the AKP could not maintain its single-party majority is that the pro-Kurdish HDP crossed the 10% election threshold to get representation in parliament in the June elections, received 13% of the popular vote. It was the first time an explicitly pro-Kurdish rights party crossed that threshold. And that threshold was, in fact, set up primarily to keep such parties out of parliament. But we need to look a little further back to 2010, when there was a popular referendum held with the question of whether or not to replace the 1980 Turkish constitution. That constitution, the current constitution, was created in 1980 after a military coup. The 2010 referendum voted yes to replace the constitution. Erdogan considered this his mandate and go forward, replace the constitution, and in his view, set up the presidential system. But that coup constitution, was opposed by major forces, people in support of democracy, basically, in Turkey, not just people in support of Erdogan. The Turkish military has had a major role in Turkish politics since the founding of the republic. There have been four military coups in the country, all in the second half of the 20th century. And you know, in particular, the military has always conceived of itself, as you were saying, as the guardians of the secular nature of the Turkish Republic. So they had a particular animosity to Erdogan's sort of Islam-infused social conservatism. And one of Erdogan's first steps as prime minister was to whittle away the power of the Turkish military, part of which was actually by using diplomacy in the Kurdish issue as opposed to a military solution.
Mm-hmm.
And he whittled the military's power successfully, even in the midst of a coup plot against him that was exposed in 2012. And in those years, say like 2010 to early 2013, there was actually a lot of praise for Erdogan by rights groups and pro-democracy groups. A lot of people believed Erdogan was making Turkey a more functional democracy that was not ruled by the military. Another big milestone came in 2011 when Erdogan announced that he would stop taking orders from the National Security Council, which was established after the 1960 coup. And that council was ostensibly a security briefing between top military and brass and the prime minister. But in reality, it was how the military set the agenda for Turkish politics. The military basically said to the prime minister, okay, this is what you're going to do this week. And the prime minister said, okay. And that had been going on for 50 years of Turkish politics and supposed democracy.
Wow.
Okay. So Erdogan kicks the military out of power. He's breezing through elections on a coalition of support from basically disenfranchised urban religious and socially conservative people, Islamic business interests, and anti-PKK Kurds in the southeast. He draws more Kurdish votes by starting this peace process with the Kurds that is simultaneously undermining the military's authority. And there's this so-called democratic opening between the PKK and the Turkish state. And, you know, even secular, what the media might sort of naively call pro-Western liberals, are at this point supporting Erdogan against the military because they want to live in a real democracy, and they see this as a step towards finally joining the EU. But the peace process doesn't lead to any real gains, and Erdogan's support starts to unravel. He loses support among the Kurds. That starts to fall away. And then 2013, the Gezi uprising happens. And the HDP picks up steam basically by making a coalition between Kurds, leftists, the LGBT community, environmentalists, other minority groups in Turkey like Armenians and Alevis. And suddenly there's a viable party in support of Kurdish rights that has a real shot at crossing that 10% election
threshold. And that what you just said is important. That is also just is a Kurdish rights party, but it's also just a kind of broad progressive socialist party, which really – you know, you had when Erdogan first came to power, as you're kind of pointing out, well, it wasn't just Kurds. You even had some pretty left-wing people voting for him on the theory that at least it was the potential of more democratization. So now for the first time, you have a party that is genuinely democratic, pro-Kurd, and left, which you hadn't really had before.
Exactly. Yeah. And so then that brings us to this year's elections. AKP loses its single-party majority. And Erdogan's plans for a new constitution are suddenly in jeopardy. Okay, so now we're at the present. What's his move? He launches a full-scale military operation against the Kurds, completely backtracks, you know, all that talk about undermining the military's approach to the Kurdish conflict. He reverses on that.
Right.
And basically, it's a political calculation that can lead to one of two things. He could be hoping that by bringing down the full might of the state against the Kurds, that he's going to attract more right-wing nationalists to support him in these November elections and get back his single-party majority to get the constitution that he wants and his presidential system. Or perhaps, you know, more nefariously, it's possible that he's hoping to provoke a protracted armed conflict and, you know, sort of bring Turkey back into the extremely violent days of the Kurdish conflict solely for the purpose of keeping the country in a permanent state of emergency and, in so doing, keeping his hold on power. It's really all about power for Erdogan, and if the country stays on the course it's on now, like I said, Turkey is heading for a full-scale civil war.
It's unbelievable. And so going to the U.S. role, and I want to be clear, I mean, the PKK is a complex group, and I think obviously you and I both share the general political desire and sympathy for certainly at the very least Kurdish autonomy. I think there's a strong case that you can make for a Kurdish state. But in all areas where the Kurds are, they need more rights, except, I mean, sort of oddly in northern Iraq, which I guess has been the sort of only positive result of the invasion of Iraq, but that wasn't really, you know, there's a lot of other factors leading to that sort of scenario
turning out a positive result because of the collapse of the Iraqi state.
So with all that said, obviously the PKK has engaged in actions that have killed civilians. There's questions about the sort of internal leadership structure. So it's not about having a rosy picture of that group. But that said, when we turn to the U.S., I mean, you're talking about, again, as you say, an incredibly effective fighting force against ISIS. Their actual sort of main primary strategic and political objectives are certainly not a problem from the perspective of even just sort of narrow, rational U.S. foreign policy. And in fact, the northern Kurds in Iraq have been, you know, quite good allies of the United States and quite good sort of operators in international oil markets and very kind of savvy players in this world. So the notion that even with, you know, Turkey, as you say, the main force of the bombing is against Kurds, even the fact that rhetorically Turkey continues to equate Kurdish factions and ISIS, which on its face is beyond ludicrous, not to mention offensive. I mean, is this just another what is the mechanism in U.S. foreign policy that is allowing us to go along with another sort of delusional calculation like this when all of the signs in terms of where this leads to in the broader crisis in Turkey, not to mention the undermining of this supposed top of the line, you know, effort against ISIS? What is the U.S. position here? What are we doing? I mean, are Republican candidates right when they start, you know, mouthing off about Obama not giving the Kurds enough support?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what, you know, obviously the thinking is at the State Department and the Pentagon, right. But it's really troubling to see this because it seems like a complete misstep again in regional politics. And I mean, when you think about, you know, you hear one of those sort of bland statements from an American politician, like, you know, we respect Turkey's rights to self-defense, or we support our ally Turkey securing its border. You know, that sounds like a kind of empty non-statement. But, you know, in this context, that actually translates to, yeah, we're okay with Turkey bombing the Kurds. That's cool.
Right.
And journalists should really be, like, holding politicians and, you know, spokespeople to account when they say statements like that. What do you mean by self-defense? You mean killing your own civilians?
Right.
And the, you know, the media has not been doing a good job on that front when it comes to interrogating U.S. policy towards Turkey and the Kurds. I mean, Obama, you know, gave a speech a few years ago, wasn't a speech, actually. So he was asked a question, I think, at the university in the U.S. about Kurdish rights. And he said he supports full Kurdish rights. You know, of course, the Kurdish people should, you know, be able to have education in their own language and all these sorts of things that they're asking for in Turkey. And, you know, but we haven't seen any actual steps in that direction from the U.S. government to push its ally, Turkey, you know, in that direction. The only calculation I see for why the State Department is doing this is, like I said, Turkey has this huge army, and it is where it is. I think that's what it comes down to.
Sure. So as a final question, we did see in these elections this past spring and that were very significant because this was the first time that electorally there was a shakeup for Erdogan. I mean, Gezi and the social movements certainly provoked and enraged him and earned a harsh and brutal response from the Turkish state. But this was the first time that it really was like, you know, electorally and politically, things are not going according to plan for Erdogan. You see, I mean, I think there's no question on the first part of your proposition that absolutely he's trying to recalibrate his base in light of shifting Kurdish politics. I think in terms of wanting a state of emergency, that's an absolutely plausible and maybe even probable argument, knowing Erdogan. So with all that said, I mean, is there a coalition emerging in Turkey domestically that can alter course on this? Or are we just – is this just – is what it is and we're going back into another horrific crisis point?
I mean, I think if we have the elections in November, that will be the moment to see what happens. I can't predict what's going to happen in those elections. I think it would be very unlikely, actually, that Erdogan is going to get his single party majority back at this point. But, you know, who knows what will happen in the course of the next month and a half, especially, you know, if the military strikes in the southeast get worse, people might just want stability. But, you know, really the HDP, I think, is the main force that can bring about peace in the country right now. The main opposition party, the CHP, is completely politically impotent, doesn't have a clear program, still hasn't for at least 5 years. So, you know, we have to look to civil society and to this left party to really, I think, provide some sort of counterpower to Erdogan right now.
The Majority Report listeners of Turkey, basically. No, it's fascinating and really disturbing, and I agree with you entirely about the importance of really sharpening what people mean when they throw out these sort of bland, generic statements about regional, you know, the border security and all the rest of it, because it's a catastrophe for the Kurds, who have had far too many catastrophes, obviously. It's a catastrophe in terms of fighting ISIS, and it could be, as you say, it could lead to a Turkish civil war. And on top of all of the other crises that are emanating out of that region right now, none of which we're effectively responding to and in many cases making worse, that's an unimaginable scenario. So, Jake Cassano, I really, really appreciate your time today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. Great chatting.
Thanks, man. Take care.
Bye.
All right, everybody.
Let's get to the story. So last week, the NYPD upheld its high standards and its extremely well-respected repertoire when they tackled former tennis star James Blake to the ground outside of a hotel he was staying at during the U.S. Open because they thought he was somebody else. Just amazing. Amazing. Just unbelievable. Now, James Blake, who, by the way, was ranked as high as number 4 in the world before he retired after the 2013 U.S. Open. So this is a known figure. I mean, it doesn't make what they did any lesser or more, depending on who they did it to. But it just shows you that, you know, if you're famous and black, it doesn't matter because you're still black. In the eyes of the NYPD. So the AP caught up with him and they asked him about what happened, and what he said is very sensible. I don't think this person should ever have a badge or a gun again. Speaking of the officer, James Frascatore, or Frascatore, who the NYPD officer who tackled him, I don't think it's too much to ask. I agree with Mr. James Blake. That doesn't sound like too much to ask. I think that that kind of police officer tarnishes the badge. And he went on to say how he respects police officers and they do great work when the majority of police officers do great work. But, you know, that person, the guy who tackled him, doesn't belong in the same sentence with those type of officers who do this great work. He also said that, "I'm sure this isn't the first time police brutality has happened, and I'm sure it's not the last time. So I want them to apologize to the people that this happens to that don't have the same voice that I have." This is speaking to the fact that Commissioner Braddon contacted Mr. Blake to apologize for the incident. Now, we're going to put the video here. There's no audio. It's not worth showing because it's surveillance video. If you watch it on YouTube, you'll see the video right now. But that video, as crazy as it is, you see the officer just walking over to James Blake, who's just looking at his phone. You can see that there's no warning given, no proof of even, no. He doesn't even show himself to be an officer because this guy isn't playing clothes. He just walks over to Mr. Blake, grabs him by the arm, swings him around, and throws him to the ground, tackling him. Now, that officer, Frascatore, has been placed on desk duty while internal affairs detectives investigate, blah, 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 blah. You know how this goes with the NYPD. They'll probably find him to do no wrongdoing, or they'll give him a slap on the wrist, or he'll get a paid vacation, or he'll get fired but get to keep his pension. Well, you know how they roll. But on top of the takedown, the use of force wasn't even reported to the chain of command like the officer is supposed to do. In fact, his commanding officers only learned of the takedown after Blake, the tennis star, spoke to the media. And of course, that only happened because he is a tennis star. Otherwise, this would have been another case of a black man being subject to police brutality in the city, New York City, and it being nothing comes of it. It goes unpunished. But like I said, that's not the craziest thing. You see, the AP reached out to the Patrolman's Benevolent Association. You know, that's one of the police unions in the city. And President Patrick Lynch, who you'll remember and recall, is the guy who said that de Blasio had blood on his hands when some crazy guy shot and killed two NYPD officers this past December. He had this to say about Blake's arrest. His wrongful arrest due to mistaken identity, where he was thrown to the ground. Patrick Lynch says this. Under fluid circumstances where the subject might have fled, and the officer did a professional job of bringing the individual to the ground. He took down the wrong guy, but man, what a beautiful tackle. I mean, really. Can you imagine?
You gotta look at technique sometimes.
Yeah. Can you imagine any other profession, anything at all, where that's an answer to something like that? Listen, the doctor performed the wrong surgery, and the patient died because of it. But if he did need a heart transplant, man, he would have gotten a great heart in that transplant. It was beautiful. The incision was perfect. The incision was perfect. Listen, that serial killer, he did some horrific, horrible thing. He murdered hundreds of men and women. But let me tell you, I've seen nobody tie a knot quite like him. That's a beautiful knot that he tied. Like, I just can't get over it. It was a professional tackle.
It's pathetic.
Like, how do you say that? I just can't get over it. Just unbelievable. Listen, the report was completely wrong. But let me tell you, the writing, I've never seen anyone string together words like that.
It was beautiful.
It was beautiful. Listen, the butcher poisoned everybody, but nobody cuts a filet mignon quite like him.
We are going to go right to the fun half, where you can join us, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. The IMs are on. Become a member of the Majority Report today. You know the deal. Costs less than a cup of coffee. It allows you to be one of our bosses, one of our many bosses, but we would love for you guys to join us that way. Also, download the app, majority.com/app. Tell everybody about the app, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, and chocolate. Get the Majority Report blend. It's carried at cafes in upstate New York, apparently. That's how good it is. People that don't even know the show are drinking it because it's just that good. Write us a review on iTunes. It helps a lot. Be evangelical. Tell your friends about the show. I couldn't help it. The other day, I was leaving a friend's apartment in Brooklyn, and I got on the elevator, and there was this nice couple. They looked like tourists. They looked like friendly tourists, like tourists that would be in Brooklyn, sort of know what they were doing a little bit, so not that annoying. But very nice people. And the lady had a nice Bernie badge on. And I said, he's doing pretty well, isn't he? And we had a little conversation about Bernie Sanders. And by the end of it, what were they going to do? They were going to go on their iTunes and subscribe to the Majority Report. We are not above that. Don't be above that either if you like the show. We will see you in the fun half.
We will.
You like that? I did. It was very ominous. 646-257-3920.
apple pie.